All right, we're back on the record for the additional direct examination of Dr. Potion. Dr. Potion, you're still under oath, so Mr. Williams, please go ahead when you're ready.
Let me get my slide. While we're waiting for the slide man to get here, let me ask you, this next section of your testimony, we're going to cover some examples of ways in which autistic children process mercury different than normal children, right? And is this what you call your evidence for a mercury efflux disorder?
Yes.
Okay. What's the first example is hair?
Yes.
Okay. We have the next slide, Scott.
Oh, here we are. This is a study done by Holmes, Waxel, and Haley. Haley is head of chemistry at University of Kentucky. It was at the time the study was done. And Amy Holmes, a private practitioner who treated autistic children, and she knew the questions about mercury that were unanswered as far as autistic children, and she knew about mercury in hair, and she remembered that most parents keep the first samples of the first haircut of the child. And so she convinced them and controlled people to bring in the baby haircuts. And the next slide will show the results. And the autistic group, this is now mercury levels in first baby haircuts. The autistic group was 0.47. The control group was 3.63. Now, this study has been criticized because the control group, 3.63, is too high as compared to the normal population. One thing one must remember is to get controls for autistics is a very difficult job for all people interested in autism research. You can always get autistic kids, whether it's hair or some other way, but to try to get age-matched and sex-matched samples is extremely difficult. But even if we look, if we forget the 3.63 and say that what normal population is usually about 1.0, you still have twice as much mercury in the hair of controlled children. In addition to this, now this was done by atomic absorption. The next slide, I think, will show the results of the MIT group, where they used neutron activation analysis, a different kind of technique for measuring hair mercury. This also is a abstract of a paper given at the American Nuclear Society. Now, most societies peer review abstracts. Where this was done here, I don't know.
Well, let me just ask you, though. You've got two studies on the hair of autistic children compared to controls. What did they find? Were they consistent with each other?
Yes, they were consistent. Both groups, although the second one was a smaller sample, they both found that autistic children had less mercury in their hair than their control or so-called normal children.
And from a toxicology point of view, what's the significance of that difference?
The significance is that there is less mercury in these cases in the blood and therefore probably more mercury in the cells, that the mercury cannot get out of the cells. Most of the work of James also shows that autistic children have less glutathione concentrations in their blood, and this also means that it would be less glutathione in the cell to bring out the mercury.
Is this evidence that autistic children tend to retain mercury to control?
This is one kind of evidence that can be interpreted as meaning that autistic children have more mercury in their cells than non-autistic children.
Okay. Now, the next example you were going to talk about was the Ip and DeSoto study again. We've already talked about that.
I just want to bring your attention to the last sentence. Let me just read it. Moreover, the hair sample analysis results offer some support for the idea that persons with autism may be less efficient and more variable at eliminating mercury from the blood.
Okay, because we had talked about Ip with respect to blood levels before. We're now talking about the Ip study on hair levels, right?
Yes.
And it was also consistent with the Holmes and the MIT study. Okay. And then There's another example of chelation therapy. If we go to slide 89. Now, what you explain quickly what chelation is, and you,
sure.
You've had some experience with chelation.
Yes. A chelating agent, metals, as I've told you earlier, are bound to proteins and other substances in the body. They're not floating around free. So in order to get rid of metals, you want to put something in the body that's going to have a greater affinity for that metal than the ligand or the protein that's holding on the metal in the body. And so by giving a chelating agent, you, if it's the right chelating agent, it will have a greater affinity for that metal, or the metal will have a greater affinity for it than for the ligand or protein to which it is attached in the body. And the term chelate comes from Greek word chelos, or claw. And essentially, a chelating agent forms a five-membered ring, usually, a claw, if you will, with the metal, and makes that metal more water-soluble. Since it has become more water-soluble, then it is excreted much more quickly and in larger amounts than if no chelating agent was given.
Okay. And this study by Bradstreet and others was a study of chelation in autistic children? Yeah.
What they did was give DMSA, we were involved in the FDA approval of this. DMSA was used originally. The FDA approval is for children with lead levels of 45 micrograms or greater per deciliter of blood. And DMSA is given to get the lead out of the body. It also can be given, used for off-label studies, as we say, because its safety has been proven, that DMSA will also mobilize mercury and bring mercury out of the body in the same way. And what Bradstreet did was to give mercury, give DMSA, this water-soluble chelating agent, to autistic children and controlled children. And depending on which figure you look at or which table you look at, you'll find a very definite increase, anywhere from 3 to 8-fold increase in mercury excretion when the autistic children were given DMSA chelating agent versus the controlled children. This is an indication that there was more mercury coming out. Now, let me again say, this study has also been criticized, and all these studies have been criticized. There are very few studies in science that we cannot criticize. One of the exercises in most graduate schools is to give a student a paper and say, we want you to report what's good and what's bad about this. These are peer-reviewed studies. You can always find something wrong with a study. This one has been criticized because they said the number of controls was too small. They also said there was bias in picking the controls, but the fact remains, the paper appeared in a peer-reviewed journal. The fact remains, it has been reported many times, both personally at meetings and in the literature, that DMSA does increase the mercury excretion.
And is
as
the,
compared to controls.
Is the result here consistent with the hair studies we talked about?
Yes, it is. It's consistent with a greater body burden, a greater amount of mercury in the cells.
Okay. All right. Then let's skip to slide 92, please. What is this study?
Okay. This is an unpublished study from our laboratory. We just haven't had time to publish it. We have, for most of the cases, 16 autistic children with 22 controls about the same ages. For mercury in particular, we had 14. There are some studies, there are some urines that just got lost in the shuffle, or there are some contaminated urines we didn't want to use. For autistic children, there are 14. For mercury studies, there are 14 children and 22 controls. The equipment that we use, the latest equipment there is available, simultaneously determines within 10 minutes all these metals on one urine sample. So we don't have all the manipulation errors that many people have if they're doing atomic absorption where they do one metal at a time. But what we notice here is that the only significant difference between autistic children and controlled children is the mercury excretion. Here we have P less than 0.03. There's another slide, which I forgot to bring with me. It shows even a greater difference with mercury. But there certainly is less mercury coming out of children, autistic children, who are not given chelating agents than normal children.
So, but, again, is this consistent now with the hair study and the IP blood study? And
it's what we would expect, yes. We're very excited to find this result. And this has been presented.
We've now seen five or six studies which show that autistic children seem to retain more mercury than non-autistic.
Yes,
children.
Yes.
Okay. Then, again, we've talked about DeSoto, but there's one quote from DeSoto I think you wanted to show in, slide 93.
Let's...
You see the underlying part?
In the DeSoto paper, just let me read the last part of it. Under figure one, they point out the variability found in circulating levels of mercury and hair mercury. So kids are different. You know, there's a widespread. And also, what is underlined, this is consistent with the idea that autism may be partly related to a lesser ability to rid the body of neurotoxins such as mercury.
Okay.
So again, this fits. And if I can have the next slide, which I think is the baby teeth. Yes. No, this is another one.
Yeah, let's.
We've talked about already, I think.
We've talked about that one. Let's go on to the next one.
I think we skipped the baby teeth, which must be 2 or 3 feet back there. Adams. But essentially, this paper shows this.
Now, what are we talking about, Doctor? Which slide? Which slide are we on, or what are you talking about?
We're now on slide.
This is slide 95. Special Master. And what is this slide? Is a study of the difference between boys and girls in the way they retain mercury.
Yes. Well, what they're measuring here is the amount of mercury excreted in the urine over a period of time. With children, the black spots, these children have amalgams in their mouth. The white spots are open circles. These children have composites used for dental fillings rather than mercury.
And amalgams have mercury.
The amalgams are mercury fillings.
And we know that mercury vapor comes off amalgams. And
it's well accepted even by the American Dental Association that mercury is emitted from these amalgams.
And does this study first show that the types of kids, boys and girls, if they had amalgams, did they have more mercury in coming out or less mercury?
What it shows is that if they had amalgams, in both cases, more mercury was being excreted than if they had composites,
okay.
Number one. Number two, more importantly, if you look at the red arrows, it shows that by the seventh year, the boys are excreting less mercury than the girls are, which is an indication that boys are retaining more mercury than the girls are. And that's what the interpretation of the authors is. Boys retain mercury more than girls by not excreting as much of the mercury.
Okay. Now, I think you're right that the slide about the tooth study is somehow got dropped out of here, but why don't you just briefly describe the tooth study to the special masters?
The study by Adams, we know from the work of Needleman, who used baby teeth as an indicator or biomarker for lead. So Adams thought he would look at baby teeth to use as an indication of mercury. And the amount of mercury or metal in the teeth is a reflection of how much is in the body at one time or another. And Adams found that the... mercury in the teeth of autistic children was at least twice as much as the mercury in the teeth of non-autistic children. Again, pointing out again indicating that these children, these autistic children, have more mercury in their tissues, and in this case, in their teeth, which are certainly considered to be a tissue or an organ.
Okay.
And just for the record, I think there is a slide number 90 refers to the Adams.
Oh, okay.
As Special Master Campbell Smith pointed out to me.
I knew it was in his report. I just didn't remember.
Can we go back, Scott, to 90?
Well, I think you just...
Yeah, slide 90 does discuss the teeth. You're right. Thank you for pointing that out.
Because that study, again, has been criticized, the tooth study, as they say, and you go to meetings, it hasn't been confirmed. Well, that doesn't mean someone tried to confirm it. It means that no one tried to do the exact experiment. And in one of these studies that we cite, the editor of that journal, the Journal of Child Neurology, made a big point of making of saying that people don't get glory by trying to repeat other people's studies. And the NIH, National Institutes of Health, of our government, does not give money to investigators to repeat other people's studies. And so the idea that the Adams work should be minimized because it has not been repeated is just pure propaganda. This doesn't belong in a scientific argument.
Okay, now, one more. Let's go to slide 97, please. And I'll ask this question. Have there been some studies that have now identified at least one genetic marker of susceptibility to this mercury efflux problem?
Yes. Woods from Seattle and his associates have shown genetic polymorphism of the coproporphyrin gene, actually the oxidase gene, and has shown that 15% of the population of the dental population in this case have a different reaction to mercury than do the rest of the dental population. And this finding represents the first report of a polymorphism. In other words, something has been changed in a gene that modifies the effect of mercury on a biological process. And they're now proposing that this be used for a biomarker of mercury exposure. It's a very readily testable phenomena.
And the type, is it your opinion that in the children that we've seen that have more mercury in their blood, more less mercury in their hair, more mercury in their teeth, do they probably have genetic differences from the others too?
I think there's no question. Most people would say they must have genetic differences to have those kinds of results.
Okay, let's go to your second hypothesis quickly about terbutaline. That's on slide 98. And if you would.
Terbutaline is an example of a teratogen that can cause some types of autism via a neuroinflammation mechanism.
Okay.
And the next slide points out that terbutaline has been a drug that has been used in the clinic to arrest preterm labor in women. We're not talking about animals now. We're talking about pregnant women. And it has been shown that the critical period corresponds to the second and third trimester in the human fetus. That if the human fetus is exposed to terbutaline and there is a predisposition to having the damage, then there will be there's a greater chance that the child will have autism. It causes decomposition of central nervous function like that report in autism.
Okay. And then I showed an opening statement an animal model of this terbutaline toxicity. It's slide 101, I think, has that paper on it.
Yeah,
we can go to that.
Yeah. Results from animals can be used to trigger studies of human populations for exposure and outcomes. And there's a paper by Zerati, I think, from the Hopkins group, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. Results are overstimulation of the ADRA receptor during an early critical period results in microglial activation associated with innate neuroinflammatory pathways and behavioral abnormalities similar to what is seen in autism.
When it says similar to what's seen in autism, it's referring to those autopsy studies of autistic children?
Yes, yes.
The Vargas paper and the Lopez,
yes.
Hurtado paper and so forth?
Yes, yes, sir.
And then is this microglial activation, is that the same thing that happened to the adult monkeys in the adult monkey study?
Yes.
With the inorganic mercury in their brain?
Yes, inorganic mercury did go up.
Okay. Let's go quickly to your summary slide on 106, please, and summarize your opinions here, if you would.
I don't think it's necessary to repeat the first one because
okay.
We don't know about species of mercury, but I think it's necessary to speak about Cavallaro et al. Study, in particular the remarkable potency of the mercury compounds to bind to selenol thiols in the active site of thyroid reductase should be a major molecular mechanism of mercury toxicity. The first hypothesis, one cause of autism, is that cells cannot efflux mercury, including thimerosal, and the DeSoto paper goes on to confirm that and the rebuttal of the IP paper. The second hypothesis, terbutaline, is an example of teratogen that causes some types of autism via neuroinflammation mechanism. Again, the Zerati and other papers show that the behavior of abnormalities after terbutaline are similar to autism. In my opinion, based on 55 years' experience of being an independent biomedical research investigator funded by the federal government and private foundations, the first and second hypotheses are scientifically reasonable and probable.
Now, let me ask you this question. Do you have an opinion as to whether or not injections of thimerosal in vaccines in human infants would deposit measurable amounts of inorganic mercury in the brains of those kids?
What would happen would be the thimerosal would be broken down to ethyl mercury. The ethyl mercury would cross the blood-brain barrier, and in the brain, that ethyl mercury would be deethylated to give inorganic mercury or mercuric mercury, which would stay in the brain.
Just as it did in the infant monkeys. Is that right?
This is the infant monkeys study, certainly a whole batch of them, including the most recent, I think, 2005 Birbacher paper.
Okay. And do you hold that opinion to a reasonable medical scientific probability?
Yes, I do.
Thank you very much. That's all I have.
All right. Any of you have questions for Dr. Poison at this point?
Not at this point.
Let me ask one question, Dr. Poison, before we go on and see what the respondent wants to do at this point. Now, you filed a expert report with us back on August 30th of last year. I don't know if you recall preparing that.
I remember preparing it and having a very short period of time to prepare it because someone dropped out because of cancer.
All right. Did you put a number of the articles that you talked about today were included in here?
Some of them were. Some of them, of course, have been published since then.
Right. Of course, articles that have been published since you wrote this report couldn't very well be in this report. I understand that. But in general, did you put in all the articles that you at the time thought were important to the issue?
At that time, I wrote that article. I put in the papers that I thought at that time were important.
All right.
I really haven't kept track, but it's sort of like preparing a lecture or at a symposium. You never finalize it until the minute before you walk in and give it. And so there are always changes to be made, especially what lasts almost a year. I'm sure there are papers. If the question is, are there papers here that are quoted that were not quoted in the initial report, the answer is yes.
And tell me why. I mean, obviously, aside from the obvious ones that were published since then.
Yeah, the major. Let's see, I don't know how to put this without making it personal. I've had two members of my family seriously ill. When I was asked to participate in this in writing that report, they were not ill. And shortly thereafter, they became ill, and I had, I think, a month from the time, I think it was Dr. Lucier who dropped out because he had cancer. So I had a very limited time to prepare that report, whereas I had much more time to prepare this talk. Does that answer your question, sir?
Well, based on Special Master Hastings' questions, I have a couple of follow-up questions, Dr. Poseyan. Were you ever asked to prepare a supplemental report, that is a rebuttal report?
I don't think so. No, because I didn't see the respondents' reports until maybe a month ago. I don't remember the exact timing, but I certainly was not asked to prepare a rebuttal. And there's nothing in here that I can think of except, well, actually, the rebuttal about does poison determine the dose, if anything, that was a rebuttal to what was brought up in the Cedillo trial. And I must actually state that, how should I put it? I certainly would like more time to read the respondents' reports. So there's no, I did not use, to my knowledge, I did not prepare any kind of rebuttal to the present respondents' reports, to best of my knowledge.
So you were not aware that there was a March deadline or early April deadline to file rebuttal reports?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. Because you know, you can't imagine what it's like to have two people in your family seriously ill.
Oh, yes, I can, Dr. Okay. Posey.
And we don't believe in health care providers. We think the family should take care of their own. And so I just don't remember the timing. I'm sorry. It was but I know no one asked me to prepare a rebuttal.
Well, let me phrase it this way then. Your slides are dated 5/12/2008, at least on Petitioner's Trial Exhibit 2. Is that when these slides were prepared?
Excuse me?
These slides.
Yes, these slides. They were prepared up until yesterday. Honestly. That's. And when did I begin? When probably this is May. I think I was told in April or the end of February when the date of this trial was set. And so it would be my normal inclination in any talk that I was prepared to give anywhere that I would try to bring it up to date and try to improve to the best of my ability to give the best talk that was most relevant.
I have nothing further.
Have I done something wrong, or I'm not sure?
No, just I think you've answered our question.
Okay.
Mr. Matanowski, how do you propose to proceed at this point? Obviously, Dr. Aposhian did cover some of the topics that were covered in his expert report and some topics that weren't covered in his expert report. Do you want to cross him on the topics that he did cover? Well, how do you propose that we proceed at this point?
We have about 2.5 hours of cross-examination based on his expert report. It seems that some of the testimony we didn't get today was matters that were in his expert report. I'm not sure how much.
Do speak up.
I'm sorry. I'm having the same problem with my voice that you are, sir. I believe we'd probably still be at about 2.5 hours to cover some of the topics that he covered today, which were covered in his expert report. Then there are some new questions that have suggested themselves, obviously, based on things that he's covered today. Although, as I mentioned in our bench discussion, there may be the subject of further proceedings or motions, I should say, after this trial or during this trial. So we could go ahead and forge ahead with what we have, which would be about 2.5 hours. We're prepared to do so, sir.
Why don't we make some use of our time? Why don't we begin your cross-examination?
Very well, sir. Could we then have a brief break for Ms. Renzi, who will be doing it, to get her notes together? I mean brief, sir, so that...
All right, how much time do you need?
10 minutes, sir.
All right.
Thank you.
Ahead.
So it's...